All right, welcome to another episode of Speed Change Repeat today here in Munich. Patrick van der Smaag, thanks for being with us here today. And I'm really looking forward to this episode, actually. You're quite an interesting person that does a lot of interesting stuff. So we always start actually the same way. Therefore, I would like to kind of, ask you to go in a storytelling way through your professional life so we and our listeners can basically understand who you are, where you come from, and where you are today.
All right. I think the first maybe important thing was when I was in the order of 12 years old, living in the Netherlands, and my dad was a GP then, and he bought a computer, and this was a Tandy TRS-80. And I think cost 10,000 in whatever currency units we had back then, guilders. So extremely expensive, and he didn't know what to do with it. So I was at home, and I was 12, and at school and at home, and so I started hacking with that and having fun, and first started programming BASIC, and then started programming assembly because BASIC is so damn slow. And I think that is that. That shaped my life a bit. In hindsight, I then reinvented the hashing algorithm because he had a tape recorder on which all his patients, he had 3,000 patients in his database, had to be read into the computer to find and so on. So you had to do something smart. So I had fun there. The second important decision was when I was 18-ish. I had to decide either to go to the conservatorium to study music, or to go to a computer science faculty, which were relatively new, not in every university back then. my dad said, don't do music because you'll end up as a piano teacher. And until today, I'm angry at him and grateful for that, because every time I go in a concert and I hear somebody else play piano, I'm always jealous that I can't do that, and I'm so shitty at playing piano. But still, I didn't end up all that bad, so it's okay. I started studying at Vrije Universiteit in Amsterdam, computer science, ended up with Andy Tannenbaum, who people in computer science know as one of the important people who even pre-founded Linux, the Minix operating system. For my PhD, went to the University of Amsterdam, and then I started working. Actually, my master's thesis, I did neural networks and Kahuna networks and Hopfield networks and other things for character recognition of comparative study. That was my first paper. Totally silly in hindsight. Hope nobody finds it. but then I went on to the University of Amsterdam, did my PhD, and started with robotics because they had an old robot which they inherited from Philips and they didn't know what to do with. So trained some neural networks to do image to grasping and devised some algorithms and some methodologies, partly derived from biology as well, by looking at how birds do grasping. And use that in a technical setting. So that's basically, and I haven't changed anything since then in my life, content-wise. So I've been always combining robotics, machine learning in one way or the other, and biological insights. So finished my PhD. I stayed in Amsterdam for another year, and then went to Germany to the German Aerospace Center. In Oberpfaffenhofen, not far from Munich, in the Robotics Institute, which was then 40 people large or so. It's now like 200 people, with Gerd Hertzinger, who was one of the big people in robotics, which I learned only afterwards, but a very fortunate choice. I had a great time there, stayed there for long, too long, but still it was great. There learned how to do research in a group, and how to build up your own group, and how to get funding, and so on and so forth. So I started specializing in getting research funding, having an own group, building up my own group, and did that for a while, focusing less on machine learning, related to the fact that in 1995 neural networks were not in vogue, en vogue anymore, right? But were sort of surpassed by support vector machines, at least for a short while. So the AI winter, as we call it now, back then it was just terrible from a funding perspective. But you shift with the research. Feeling that's out there and the research funding, of course. So I shifted more in biomechanics. I shifted a bit in neuroengineering, but also to a large part in brain-machine interfaces. So I combined those, and we did nice work with respect to brain-machine interfaces using EMG to surface EMG sensors on the arm to do control of prosthesis, hand prosthesis for people without a hand. All in a research setting only, I must say that. We continued. One of the last things we did there was brain-machine interfaces through an implant in the cortex with a participant in Providence, Rhode Island. So we had a collaboration with Brown University for a short while, where we showed that you can use this brain implant to control a robot arm to have again mobility. That was a person. She had had a brainstem stroke a long time before we did the experiments. It was actually very nice, with the frustration, however, that it's only research work, right? You can do all of that stuff, and it's really cool and it's great what you can do. But then, in the end, going to a product, to a something that really helps the patients or the participants or the people who need that technology, that last bit, I never managed to solve that in a way. It's costly. It doesn't bring any money for anybody, because you have to individualize all of the solutions every time, and there are no solutions that I've seen to this day, and that's quite sad. I, in the meantime, got a professorship at TUM. Went there for a few years, focusing much more than on machine learning, which was restarted being popular in 2006 due to this seminal paper by Hinton and the other guy whose name the first author whose name I always forget. Became more popular after 2008 and 9, when CNNs were becoming powerful and started really working and beating old benchmarks and so on. 2010, 11, I switched almost completely then to machine learning. And have been doing that again as a major focus since then. Always combining it with some use cases with respect to robotics, not in an industrial setting, but in an experimental setting. So we did tactile sensing, we did grasping with that, we did robot control and all of that stuff with that. Relatively successfully, I had some good papers, but little real world impact. 2006, I got an offer from Volkswagen to do that kind of research within Volkswagen, and I've been here since then. And the ideal situation being able to do fundamental research, but also having the funding to run that kind of lab. That's and on top of that, being close enough to applications that you can actually go to an application with whatever you're developing. And especially those last two things are frustrating, especially with respect to machine learning in a university, in my opinion at least. If you, as a professor in a lab, in such a lab, I spent, I don't know, 80% of my time hunting for grants. And you can be good at that, but still it's 80% of your time. And not to forget the time of the people working in your lab who have to assist in that and help writing proposals and reports and all that stuff. So I got rid of that part because I got a very decent base funding here in Volkswagen. Plus, and that's maybe even more important, I now have the possibility to, whatever we develop, to actually test in field settings. And certainly we don't always do that, and I would also say, but never publicly, that we don't do it often enough. but we do that, and that's, I think that's very important for machine learning. Writing a paper is great; it's very important putting this stuff out there, but maturing your methodologies that they actually work in a real setting, more than in a silly MNIST kind of example. That's, I think, very important and differentiates between something that's good and something that isn't. So research, fundamental research, extremely important. But if you never connect it to an application, especially machine learning, I think has an issue. So right now, I've got a wonderful group here. And I think people are happy working here, and we have a lot of fun doing our work, and also many challenges in doing our work and applying our work. It gives me many headaches, but pleasant headaches.
Right. You know what's interesting? When you tell about your basically different stops that you had in your life, right, and exactly pointing out these typical issues, right? It's so interesting to me, because those are the ones that you hear all the time, right? From, let's say, people that have been in academics for a while and are active within this field. And there's a lot of, we will dive into more to the work what you guys are doing here at the lab. But I want to start more at the beginning, because I think that is quite interesting to know on how that actually started. Because as far as I know, the lab has been existing since 2016, right?
Correct, yes.
All right. And so what I'm interested in is, how was that? Because you said I was approached by the Volkswagen Group, and I mean, everybody knows the Volkswagen Group is huge, right? 600,000 employees. Mm-hmm. And it's a really big deal. And in regards to funding, yes, definitely, there's a huge chunk that comes with that. And I want to know, how was it that they approached you? Like, what was the idea? Did they come to you with, like, okay, so we have this idea that we want to set up a research lab within machine learning, and we would like you to, let's say, head it? Or what was the story about there?
Well, certainly. So Volkswagen has had before that, and it still exists, a data lab, which is focusing on applying machine learning and data analytics within Volkswagen Group. That has been existing, I think, since the beginning of 2014, and has demonstrated where you can save money within the group, within all the brands, the 13 brands that exist. In their processes, in their after sales, and all of this stuff, and in many cases that has been realized and implemented, and so on. And that's been growing successful, but there are a few problems. One problem is that the field is progressing so fast with respect to machine learning that you can't stem that within a company by getting the people in. Also, the job situation, the job market is, of course, currently extremely difficult, right? And everybody who is good in machine learning can get, I don't know, 5 job offers in a day, something like that. In order to have a connection between that research part and the interna, and of course it's very close to interna of a company. Of a multinational company, the idea was to set up this research lab, which bridges that gap, and that's the role we play. So we have a very large stake outside of the company. So being placed within the research community, this lab has, but of course there's also a stake inside the company that connects to the different labs, and also to the brands, and to the other departments within the whole group. So the idea was from the beginning, yes, let's make a research lab that focuses on fundamental research, but also puts that bridges that from research to the application.
Right. But I guess that is quite, I mean, that is quite difficult, because
it's very difficult.
And
yes,
I want to dive more. I want to dive deeper into this actual thing. So, because doing fundamental research, right, and being at the forefront of, let's say, the development within, the techniques and everything, right, that is one thing. Mm-hmm. But really, let's say then, filtering that, right, filtering that and communicating that, either, let's say, kind of like a push approach. So there's two sides, right? Either you push inside the, let's say, for commercial use, right, within the group, or there's a pull. So and as you say, yes, that's quite difficult. So how do you approach that?
Well, you shouldn't forget that there is one basic difference between applied research and fundamental research, at least in my interpretation. In applied research, you're trying to solve a problem, right? A department has X that doesn't work or that needs to be optimized, and you go to a research department and they solve that for you. And while they're solving that, they have to develop new methods or whatever. A research, fundamental research department, as I see it, does it the other way around. You develop a methodology because you know that problem is not solved, and it's a general methodology that solves 1,000 problems at the same time, at least in theory. And once you have done that, and once you have understood the methodologies and bridged there a whole gap of things that need to be done, then you can look for a customer of your methods. And that's something you can't live from financially, of course. You could never build a company on just that because it's too costly. But it does give you the possibility to develop things that are 5 or 10 years away and then still bring them to application, because there are those few applications, and especially you mentioned the company with more than 600,000 employees. I can tell you there are lots of applications internally where you can test something which may not seem so very obvious at the beginning. So we first of all, we're not bothered by applications. That's what I like to say. I don't care about if there is an application for this method or not. But in each and every case, in the end, we develop a method. Of course, we do something technical, right? So we don't do something totally out of this world. But those methods which are developed certainly are then brought by us to a customer, because I know that they have this problem. Or the customer comes to us because they know that we do that weird stuff, and we demo that, and so on and so forth. So but yes, it's not easy, because it is a huge company, and I can't preach to 600,000 people every week. Of course, that's ridiculous. So the reaching out works in both ways, and so far we are good there, and we have enough to do related to optimality and control, and in the end that applies everywhere. And we've done a few things that were successful, and we've done a few things that are not successful yet, and we're still a few things in the pipeline. But having said that, 80% of our investment is in basic research.
Right. Yeah, that is quite interesting. I like that you pointed out the difference between, let's say, fundamental and applied, let's say, research. From your perspective, then, if you like, there's a clear differentiation between these two, right? Where you say, okay, with fundamental, with what you guys are doing, right, we have more or less the freedom to really look into things that, let's say, are not really obvious in terms of the application with inside, let's say, Volkswagen, mm-hmm. right? But which may turn out to be useful.
Exactly,
right?
Yes.
So how do you then basically, because both are necessary, right? So and then an applied, so you talked about the data lab that Volkswagen has, right? Is that then the arm that is doing more the applied side?
Yes. Okay. Exactly. So there is also research going on in the data lab, mm-hmm. but that's F&E. Forschung und Entwicklung, research
right.
and development.
Right.
So their R&D, nice things come out of there, certainly, and they do wonderful stuff, but they do it always to solve a particular problem.
Okay.
And it's a different approach, right?
Okay.
Whereas our first milestone is, well, we think, we know that we have this problem. We start looking into, you do the mathematics, you do a proof of concept on a silly data set, and then you submit your first paper. And you hope it gets published, and if not, you go for the second one. That's fine. And you then improve the methodology on bigger data sets. You correct the problems that you find, and so on. And that's a process of half a year, 2 years, depending on what it is about. And it can be so. We have problems where one person works in it for half a year, but we also have problems where four people are working in it for 2 years continuously. Right. Sometimes even without a paper, because I don't like to publish things which are half-baked.
Right. Okay. So then for me, what is interesting, because you worked in both worlds, right? You said you work like you were in the academic world and now you are basically leading this corporate research arm, right? And what I want to know is when you started this role, right? What was the major difference between those two worlds, right? Except from the funding, but I rather in the approach that you, let's say, take on leading, like, for example, a team.
Well, it's a huge difference because and I have to correct you apart from the funding because that plays a big role or plays a big role. In university, you usually you get a bit of base funding, but that's nothing big. You get to write a proposal. And if the proposal gets funded, you have to do the work that you promise in that proposal. Typically, a project is like 3 years or 4 years long. It's a typical time. So you define beforehand, and very often that's in a consortium with one or five or 10 other partners. You define what you're going to do in the 3 years. Of course, it's a lot of just guessing and projecting and so on. But in general, you have an idea what you're working on. You try to match the project to the kind of work you're doing, but it works both ways. Now, that means that with the projects that you have, and typically in university I had like 3, 4, 5 projects running in parallel, you have sort of already defined your research path over the next few years and will continue doing that as you need to get new projects. Now, you come in a corporate world and you say, okay, I get a certain budget, which is a decent budget with which you can hire a lab. Then you have to completely turn it around and say, okay, what the hell am I going to do now? Because I have no challenges in front of me, right? No defined challenges. There is nothing that I need to promise by this and there, by then or then or then. But instead, you have to completely start freely planning your future, planning which pieces of research you want to focus on, which topics do you focus on in which way, how serious do you take it with respect to how large do you allot the group on that, and so on. So there's much more intrinsic planning involved. And that's something you need to learn, of course, if you've never done that. It's to a part also a democratic process, right? We're all researchers here, and researchers have a very strange way of liberal thinking, right? They think they can determine their own life. and I think that's great because that's where the ideas come from. In most cases, the ideas don't come from me, but from the people working on that in 9 of 10 of the cases, at least, if not more. So with that, you have to work with that freedom that people have into doing their own research, writing their own papers, writing their own master thesis or their own PhD thesis, but also making a plan of where do I actually want to be in 2 years? What do I want to attain in 2 years? And what's the research path? What are the interesting research questions which might also have an application? Right, because the application thing, I think, is important. Even though that doesn't mean for me that each next Golf or each next Porsche is going to drive with this piece of software, but it means that those things can actually solve a problem, and let's indeed try to solve that problem within the operation of a company as big as this. And to tell you the truth, we do, of course, a lot of that in company, but we also do that with other research groups. So I'm actually working on extras, space applications on exploding red dwarfs,
right,
to see where we can use the methodologies and other applications. We use medical applications and so on. So it's not just Volkswagen, but most of it is.
So then let's talk about successes. I mean, because what you mentioned in when you were going basically through your different stages is that the thing that kind of like frustrated you is that from going into this, like, okay, you tried it out in a research environment, right, in this like proof of concept style, but then actually implementing it in the let's say, you know, on large scale, mm-hmm. right? So let's talk about, let's say, some of the things that you can talk about, of mm-hmm. course, openly, successes that let's say found their way into let's say scalability and actually wide scale usability.
Yeah, okay, let me go back with my frustration first, because I think my biggest frustration was when we were working with this patient with her brain implant, And it was great fun to do that kind of work for both sides. I think everybody loved it. But in the end, you shake a hand and you write a paper and that's it, right? And I tried to solve that by making a non-for-profit organization for supporting tetraplegic or for assistive robotics. Failed that out of not having enough time to put into that. So right now, indeed, we are in a different situation where we don't focus on that anymore, but on applications in this company. I think I'll give you one, which was a very nice project we did last year or the year before, I forgot. What we did there is look into predicting charge of a battery in an electric car. And it was actually a project from Audi Motorsport, so Formula E of Audi. The problem is that there you get each team gets the same battery at the beginning of the race, and you get a simulation of the battery in terms of a Simulink block, and that's it. And now you have to drive. And what you want to have is a situation, of course, where first of all the battery doesn't overheat. Secondly, where the battery is maximally empty at the end of the race. Right? If it's empty too early, if it's empty too late, then you didn't accelerate enough. So that's very hard to predict because you have, first of all, the dynamics of a battery, and secondly, you have the behavior of the driver. They've got an internal state, you've got a control input, and now it happens that we were working on models where we learn simulation of dynamic environments, of stochastic systems, basically. And the simulation is learned based on one thing, first of all, the history of that thing, and secondly, the control input that that thing has. That basically describes the whole world, right? Everything is a dynamical system which has an external control, external forces working on it. In this case, the dynamical system is the battery. The external forces is how much the battery is being depleted because of the acceleration. So we could use that to predict the behavior of the battery within an accuracy of 1% in 50% of the cases and 2% in 90% of the cases. I know these numbers because they're on slides, which I sometimes present. And over the whole race, which takes in the order of 40 minutes, I think. So a very accurate prediction. You can say if the driver does this, I know what the charge and state of the battery is after 40 minutes. And then you can use that to conversely start optimizing how to drive in order to make the battery at this state at the end of the race. So you can pre-compute in the simulator of the battery, of the battery used in its environment, what the optimal driving strategy is.
But how would you monitor, what parameters would you monitor on driving behavior?
How much current is being drawn from the battery.
Okay.
Right. That's directly related to the accelerometer.
Okay.
To the, not the accelerometer, the what's it called? A gas pedal. It's not a gas pedal in an electric car. What is it called? Well, exactly.
I'm over ass. Let's just call it gas pedal. E-pedal. Let's just call it E-pedal.
I like that one. Okay, the E-pedal.
The E-pedal, yeah. Well, but isn't interesting. I mean, that needs to be quite recent, right? Because Formula E.
Formula E
has been quite successful, right, in the past years.
Who has? Audi has?
I mean, no, Formula E.
Oh,
the
I know, yes.
Quite successful, yes. Okay. Yeah. So you've been cooperating with Audi in that, right? Audi Motorsport, okay.
Yeah.
And they so basically then... they applied that to their racing then.
Yes, exactly.
That is quite interesting. Yeah.
So that's an example, and that of course is then immediately interesting for the whole battery thing, right? Because batteries in use in cars is a relatively new thing, and it's a absolutely abuse of batteries, right? The normal thing of a battery is you put it in somewhere and it draws a more or less constant current. In a car, you use a lot of current for a short time, and then of course use no current anymore. It's a totally different behavior of batteries, and there is no good understanding of how that affects the health of your battery and stuff like that. So those are things we are typically looking into, is to how to make a perfect or perfect is a silly word, a better simulation of a battery, not based on its chemical properties and its chemical understanding of how it works, but based on the actual behavior when you're using it.
What methods have you been using in that?
DVBF.
All right. Okay.
That doesn't say anything because it's our name. It's a deep variation.
Did you come up with a?
That's a method we developed. Yes.
All right. Okay.
I was just
going through my brain because I was going through the papers that you published.
Okay. I was like, okay. It's a Bayesian application to a probabilistic neural network. Basically, it's an autoencoder neural network.
Okay.
Which creates internal compact representation of the data it sees. So you put data in, it compacts that to something which has certain stochastic probabilistic properties, and then we can do filtering of those compact representations.
Right.
So extracts unsupervised learning the important data out of the important information out of the data that we observe. System does it by itself, and then we can do inference on those compact representations. And without a piece of paper, and doesn't help here, right? It's hard to explain. So read a paper or watch.
Because the thing is, I was going through your papers the ones that you published that are let's say where I have could find the link on the website and
you find them all. Yes.
Right, okay.
Yeah, that's a 2070 paper, the first one. We have adapted that. We have found some weaknesses in that. We're currently working on a new version. So,
in this case, by the way, this is quite interesting. Is this then kind of like because you follow an open source approach, right?
Yeah.
And in that case, is it then because this is obviously, let's say, supporting the let's say the efficiency and ultimately productivity of the racing team for Audi.
In this particular application.
Okay. Is it then IP? Officially,
of course, it's IP.
Okay.
Yes. But we never published that particular application for two reasons. First of all, because it's, of course, proprietary. That's the number one reason. But there's another reason is that for us as a research group, that particular application is not interesting as a scientific stake.
Yeah.
Right, so I'm more interested in publishing the methodology itself and showing that on as many open or publicly available or whatever data sets that we can to show that it's mature and to apply it to things. That's why we have a robot lab, right? Because we like to apply our methods to dynamical, complex dynamical systems. And that's the paper. And then if we apply it to something which is proprietary in the company, well, there is no reason for me to, I wouldn't even want to publish it because that doesn't add much more to that part of the scientific community. Of course, others would be, but okay, it's proprietary, so that's fine.
Yeah.
So the method everybody can use, anybody can use, that's fine. And we also...
They can use it then for their own application.
Sure.
And then build it themselves.
Sure.
So, and the thing is, I want to make the jump now to this huge discussion that is kind of like going on in Europe from, okay, how is it possible that we are not seeing on such a large scale the successful move from research to product? And I guess you have a really strong opinion on that and
certainly
basically follow that. And because that is kind of like if you, because I talk to a lot of people, let's say in the community and let's say there are different companies and oftentimes, well, there is people that say no, well, we don't really have a problem, right? But let's say the vast majority still says like, yeah, that is a problem that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your take on that?
So indeed you can paint a bleak picture or a rosy picture, and I think as a person I would certainly start for the rosy one as a principle, but I think in this case it actually applies. You should not forget that Europe does not have companies like Google and Microsoft and so on, which basically are companies that trade on data. Europe, to a large part, and of course that's certainly true for Germany, but for most countries, focuses on production. And production has one problem in that from a data perspective, it's much harder to interface to that. It's much more heterogeneous, and the numbers are much smaller with respect to how many end users you can reach. I give you an example. We had a discussion with Audi a long time ago, and went to production, and they said, "Yeah, it's quality control and so on is all wonderful, but you have this press here, and this press that costs, I don't know, millions and millions of euros, so you don't buy a new one every 2 years. It makes no sense economically. And this machine may be standing there for 20 years, but the interface to it is a CRT. It's an old terminal, right? And that terminal is next to the machine, and that's it, because that was the technology 25 years ago. Now, how the hell are you going to do quality control on something like that? That is not so trivial. So in any production scenario, you've got the problem, first of all, that you don't have so much data, or it's difficult to get. And the second problem, which is maybe even more important, is that supervised labeling of the data, human annotation, is almost always impossible. Look at picture annotation. Right? You go to a Facebook page and you see 100 pictures of a cat, and somebody writes the word cat with there in there, and you don't get 100, but you get billions of those pictures. So you can do that annotation between the word cat and the picture quite automatically by what people do, and that's all human annotation. In production, you have no way of annotating the output of the sensors of a robot by a human. So you have to look in totally different methodologies. First of all, methodologies using few data, but also methodologies not looking into supervised learning, but in unsupervised learning, in order to be able to deploy that. So I think it's part of a large part of the fact is that we are looking in a total different set of applications for these methodologies. Now, if you take that as a standpoint, then Europe is ahead of other continents with respect to methodology and applications, because the other ones haven't even been starting thinking about that. Image recognition is, I think, probably 80 or 90% of the applications of machine learning in most companies and most countries. It's basically solved for those kind of settings. You can say a lot negative things about CNNs, how they don't work and how they are not... That's what biology do, that's all true, but still they work much, much better than the old SIFT methods that were successful 10, 15 years ago. So it's a different realm of applications, and that makes slower in applying that. Second thing, of course, the old story about GDPR, well, it's not old, but people complaining about how GDPR hinders us in applying machine learning. Well, I don't think anybody in Germany would be happy with street cameras tracking us. I don't know many people who like that idea, whereas it is popular in other countries. So we certainly need to look into methodologies that can do the kind of stuff we need to do with respect to security, with respect to whatever, but also take privacy concerns into account. And you can do that. There are methods for that.
So what are exactly the opportunities then for Europe? Because, of course, I mean, there's a difference between building, because you said it, yeah, Europe is more from a production standpoint, right?
Yeah.
That's their history, their strength, right?
Yeah.
There's, of course, a difference between building huge machinery and products where people click on ads, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly.
So, do you have like a picture in your head where you see or where you can point out opportunities for Europe?
Well, I think since Europe has this competitive advantage with respect to production, I don't think we should try to build our own IT multinational and compete with the Amazons, Googles, Facebooks of this world. I don't think that makes any sense. I think we should keep focusing on that, and I think we should, and that's exactly what's going on, invest a lot in research in this field, because, I don't know, 90-ish percent of applications of machine learning are in supervised learning. Supervised learning doesn't exist in biology. It doesn't exist in the form you see it in machines, right? Biology does something totally different. It does exploration. It does something reinforcement learning like-ish. I think it's different, but it's a different story. And it does mostly unsupervised learning in a very efficient way. So we should try to look in those methodologies if we want to get to a situation where production is going to be efficient and individualized and without simple manual labor, which is not affordable in Europe. And I think that's where we are going, even though it's a long path. It will take a while. But like things like autonomous factories, right? I know a few companies which are focusing on that. It's a wonderful thing how you can completely automate a factory in combination with how do I shape my product to do that and how do I shape my customer needs to fit that product design in order to do automated individualized design and production. Right. It's possible, but it's not here tomorrow.
Right. The thing is every country somehow has their, let's say, specialty, right? And I mean, for Germany, of course, because you say in general production, right? But then again, there's like different things that you can produce, right? That you can manufacture. And for Germany, of course, that is the automotive industry, right?
It's one of the big ones,
right?
Yes,
there's
certainly
also other ones. But what I find interesting actually is, maybe we can go a little bit into that, is when we look at the automotive space, right? Now Volkswagen has also announced to, let's say, create an own company around autonomous driving.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you see this field? Like, what is your perception of like the developments within computer vision and like different approaches to it? And then comparing it to, for example, like the different competitors that arise either in China or, for example, the big one that we have in the US.
So I have to be very careful, of course, in case my colleagues are listening to this. So let me try to be politically correct.
Right.
First of all, I will be one of the first users of the methodologies once it's out there, because I think it's important. I hate driving. I'm a cyclist and I use public transport and bikes wherever I can. First bikes, then public transport, and the last option is a car. But I use cars and I do drive, and I think it's totally silly because I can do better things with my time. But it's necessary. The development of autonomous driving I find from a scientific perspective fascinating, because I think, if I'm not mistaken, it would be the first time where we have to interact with the machine at eye level. So you have to accept as a human, to accept this car as a cognitive entity. Like crossroad in the city where there are no traffic lights, you have these situations where you're interacting with a driver as a cyclist. I do that on a daily basis. You have this damn car driver who has no understanding of cyclists and what should be done and what not. But you look at a person or you look at their movements and you can use that to predict what they're doing. And the other way around, of course. They do the same with you. Now, this then has to be done between a machine and you. And I think that has never happened in the history of mankind, that you interact like that with a machine. So I think that's a very interesting barrier, how that's going to work, how much people will have to adapt or how much machines will have to adapt. That's not clear yet. Apart from that, the technical challenges that are there for autonomous driving, I think they are overseeable to a large extent. Maybe not all of them, but to a large extent we understand how most of those things can be solved. And Waymo, they show that they can do that pretty well, right? And there are other car producers or autonomous driving producers who drive around successfully and have had good success rates. So that's soluble. The legal battle is a fascinating one, which I would love to watch once it opens.
The bigger one.
The biggest one, yeah. And that will open someday, I'm sure. And I dare not predict how long it will be until that one really starts and until those things. If it's, I hear numbers between 2022 and 2050, and for me, that's all the same. It's not tomorrow. That's clear.
There's, yeah, I mean, there's. I would agree on that. The technical side is not the problem. I mean, in terms of understanding what driving is from a technological perspective.
Right? Yeah.
What you have with the ADAS systems that you have already now.
Yeah, but you need dependability and probably something like explainability in court and stuff like that. And
yeah.
And that's where.
Especially because it will not just go from like zero to, you know, five.
Well, that's clear because there is already five on the road, right?
Exactly. So, and especially this point that you mentioned with the human machine interaction, that is let's say a big one, I guess, where I think that what's interesting to watch in this space, because it's kind of like its own space with its like own hardcore community.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Where people fight each other with, okay, what is like computer vision only, or you know, like with the sensors and the combination of it and stuff like that. So that is quite interesting. But what I think is they're really interesting to see is the lack of, especially for like, for example, Tesla. It will be interesting to see on when the other ones will follow with such systems, with the lack of driver monitoring, you know, where I mean, you see the cases of like how people abuse that, and that's because people ultimately are stupid, right? I mean, on a large scale, just to drop it like this, right?
But yeah, it's true.
That people will abuse it. That's always the case with
certainly.
Things, right? With whatever you give them, they will find ways.
They will game it, yes.
Exactly, yeah. And the lack there is quite difficult, you know. And then combining that with the legal discussion, right, and also the infrastructure needed, right? I mean, I want to see what would be the better option to move within New York, for example, you know, a self-driving car or a bicycle, right? Or ultimately old-fashioned metro.
I was there a while ago and a few weeks ago, and I decided to get out of my taxi and go on foot.
Yeah.
It was faster.
That is interesting. I think what is interesting to in what direction we could go now is kind of this comparison then, you know, between geographical regions, because I quite like that, because I mean, the community of machine learning is a global one, right? Especially research is global, right? So
yeah.
I mean, it lives especially with the open source approach, it's about exchange, right? Exchanging with
and that's nice, right? Because I've been in, I know many communities, the neuroscience community, robotics community, and but the machine learning is specifically very open source. Only publishes not behind paywalls, which is wonderful. Open sources much of the software that is used, I would say most, but whatever that means. So there is a very strong open source feeling for all of these people, and that's wonderful. Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, especially also for you know, for example, for you having the possibility then to collaborate also with different, you know, labs, for example, you know,
yep.
I've seen that you guys also have been, let's say, in contact with DeepMind, for example,
mm-hmm.
right? So, but I want to dive into is this, or your perception of the developments, let's say, on these three areas that the public likes to talk about, right? So what's going on in China, basically, right? With also the perception on business and politics, right? With the developments within AI there, versus let's say what's going on in Europe and of course the US, right? Because the many conversations that I have, you know, it's there's this one thing that always comes up with this. Okay, there's kind of this doomsday feeling or kind of mentality, you know, in Europe, and with this kind of like negative outlook on the developments within there, you know, with the capital that is taken and let's say the government push to mm-hmm. support these things, you know, what is your take on these things?
So I've got two different views, I think. First of all, I don't know China well, so I hardly ever was there. I was there only very shortly, so I can't say much. Not more than I can perceive from where I am now. But having said that, I've been around for a while, and the fear of China was actually of the Chinese power and development and so on was even there when I was a kid. That's a long time ago. 40 years ago or so. So even then, people said, well, you know, there will be a time soon in the next 10 years where Europe will be the poor man in the world, and the Chinese will have everything. If they will either commercially or by a war rule the whole world. That was even in the days of the Cold War. It didn't happen because... or you can also say it didn't happen yet, but I think it's still a world, right? And I don't like this view of Asia or China versus Europe versus the US. I don't think, for me, it doesn't feel like that. I even see that there are many political things going on in Germany, and I'm involved in a few of them with respect to machine learning, and it's always the first thing: how can we develop Germany? And I think that's a totally wrong question. I think the first question you're allowed to ask is, how can we develop Europe? And the second question, or the other way around, which one is first or second, is how can we develop the world? I think that's much more important. And in the end, you know, if Europe goes down, then China goes down, and the US goes down, the whole world goes down, and we're all interconnected, and you can't take one against the other there. So I don't support this point of view as a principle. At the same time, of course, you know that I forgot how many billions it is that China invests in quote AI unquote, but it's a lot. It's much more than Europe does, and I know that most of it goes into startups and applications and so on. But certainly a non-negligible part of that goes into research as well. Certainly non-negligible if you compare it to what Europe invests. So if you look at publication records, the last one, of course, that I saw was up to 2018. Europe is still number one in number of papers in this field. But I think in the 2091, China will have surpassed that number one. So there will certainly be a period of time where China will be a forerunner in this field, maybe also the US, or maybe Europe, or maybe it will be a tie, whatever. I think an important thing there is to continue this openness, which is a European way to do that, and certainly an American way in the research community as well. I don't know if that exists in China in the same way. I would presume that it is less so. Still, they're working on different problems. They're working on totally different set of applications. Supervised learning, as I mentioned, being a big thing, and whatever. I don't know. I think it's fine the way we're doing right now. I think Europe has nothing to be afraid of at this very moment. I don't know how that's going to be in the next 5 or 10 years, but looking back in the past, I don't see an earth shift coming anytime soon. I think it will be different, but I don't think we have a huge problem ahead.
I think people are just let's say scared.
It was not a very good answer. Actually, I don't know.
Well, the thing is, I understand your point, but I also understand, let's say, the more general public, right? Because, and also people, let's say, that are, you know, if you are not in a field, like if you're not an expert, right? Mm-hmm. Let's say from a politician's point of view, right? Mm-hmm. You know, everyone is talking about AI, right?
Sure.
So you also need to talk about AI,
sure.
Right? And everyone, sure. and there's a lot of people that say, well, AI is so important, everyone has to pay attention. If you don't pay attention, then you're doomed, right? And I think people are just scared in general because, you know, as you said, 40 years ago, there was a different discussion, right? Because they were doing something very well and they've been focusing on something. And then people had the feeling that at their geographical area, they were not focusing mm-hmm. enough on that. So they mm-hmm. were scared that they would come and then basically use this as
yeah.
this leverage, right?
Yeah.
And the same thing, I think, goes now for China and the
yeah,
US, right?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. But of course, it's hard to predict, right? So I have... Personally, I have no fears because of looking back on how the development is, that it is much slower than we fear or hope. At the same time, we also see that development is going much faster than it did 20, 30 years ago, right? And with methods like machine learning, deployment of new techniques is going much faster, so that maybe changing our society. I don't think that 5 years from now 30% of the people will lose their job because of AI. It's totally ridiculous, that view that you see often.
I think the major difference is there, just that, and you can then think about, okay, what is the effect this will bring, is that the speed of the adoption rate from a technological mm-hmm. point of view, of, and then again this discussion about product, right, about bringing technology, really like implementing technology in form of products and services within society, right? The adoption rate in China there, from, let's say, what you can read up on and what you hear and talking to different people, right, is, there's not even a comparison to
that. Yeah, naturally, because they start from zero in many cases, exactly. Right? You can build a new city there, and we can't do that here.
Yeah.
So certainly they have that advantage in being able to develop such things very quickly and experimenting there very quickly, which we can't do in Europe because we have all this legacy stuff.
Right.
Is that an advantage for them or a disadvantage for us? I don't see that. I think our legacy stuff is important for every individual who lives in Europe or who loves Europe or whatever, and I think it's also in our advantage to be able to say, well, this is a new methodology, I can use it, but how can I use it to improve, rather than just let throw it at it and see what happens. I think the kind of social credit system that exists in China is a very interesting social experiment, it's like, it's fascinating that somebody tries that, and I'm so happy it's not here.
Yeah. I had this discussion as well, and that ultimately, I think, is a big discussion, but one where I personally think it's a question of culture and personal perception and perspective.
Certainly, yes.
Right? So, and there's just a difference, you know, if they think, yep. if they value, for example, security that much higher, you know, than privacy, right? Then that is how their culture basically works, right?
Well, as far as I know, but as I said, I don't know China well enough to give any
exactly.
good insight there.
Yeah, all good. I want to go, and because we're almost actually at the end.
That's so sad.
It's quite indeed an interesting a conversation that we're having. I want to get actually from you... again, from two perspectives. One, so from the good side and from kind of the more, let's say, bad side. So, and in terms of developments within, let's say, machine learning or something that you can call AI, mm-hmm. whatever perception you have from AI. So positive developments within this field, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the contrary to that, things where you say, okay, this is something where I'm not feeling very well with, and where I'm actually more worried about. If there's such a thing, there can also be.
Okay, so
might also not be the case.
The first one is easy.
Right.
As I mentioned in the beginning, I did neural networks for my master's thesis, which wasn't called master's thesis back then, but same difference. And my PhD thesis in the late 80s and early 90s, and I understood them well, used them well, and so on. It was all fun and great, but what was missing, or lacking, was a mathematical basis with which you can describe those methods and first develop them on paper and see what you actually want to do before you start doing experimenting. We immediately went to experimenting. You throw in your data, you twiddle your thing until you're happy with your answer of 0.3. Right now, we have come into an era where machine learning and neural networks are combined. I mean, with machine learning, I mean probabilistic machine learning. So the whole field of probability theory, statistics, and neural networks or other methods of machine learning are now intertwined in such a way that my neural network, and in the end, I don't care if it's a neural network or something else, but my neural network is an efficient way of computing some kind of probability theory stuff that I did on paper, and I think that's correct and I should do. So, and that makes things great, because then I can work on the mathematics, I can formalize a problem, do it mathematically, and once I've done that, then I can pour my neural network magic on top of that, and then actually compute it in an efficient way. That's so much faster than it was 30 years ago, where those two communities were to a large part separate. There's still a large part of neural networks who are not interested in that part, but that's fine, but you need both things. It takes two to tango, but the combination of the two makes that field so much more interesting, and also a field of which you know that this is not just experimental science, but this is actually something with which we can work. And even if neural networks go out of vogue next year or 5 years from now or 20 years from now, I don't know, then the next good thing will be in their place and will be more efficient and better. Maybe it's quantum computing or something else, and then we can use that and still go on with the same theory, but with a better approximation to the theory and a better computational basis. So I think that's after, it started with efficient computing and more data sets, it started with that, but that was the enabler for this field to then really bloom and become a mature research field with mature applications. From a negative side, what I'm very afraid of is hype, overpromising, and of course I enjoy the hype. It's still there, because I live on that, right? I get my funding through that, and all fine, and everybody in machine learning does that. But you also know that hype is the beginning of the end. There will be a time where neural networks or machine learning is not so much in vogue anymore. I can't predict when that will be. And it probably won't be so bad as between 95 and 2006, or between, 69 and 1984 or 1986 or something like that, 69 and 1986. It won't be so bad this time, but it will certainly come that it's going to be less important and less talked about and less funded in particular. So I'm afraid of people expecting things from these technologies that are currently not feasible, and not feasible in the foreseeable future, because I see that all the time. At the same time, I'm afraid of people being afraid of these technologies. And you see that in the public, right? That very often people, they have the discussion about what are the numbers? How many percent, 70% will be jobless in by when?
I guess you can just put it as an X.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've got all of these silly stories out there. Which I know, of course I can't prove it, but I know from my background and understanding that that's bogus. But I think it's very important to inform the general public of what we can do, what's possible, what is being done. Take fear, but also give them a realistic view of what might be happening or what's being worked on. And at the same time, I think we should be very careful in how we deploy these methodologies, right? GDPR, I love the idea of GDPR, even though many problems with it, as we all know that, but the idea of GDPR is great, because it gives you your own private sphere back, right, as an individual. And we need to go in a situation where not just your data is being carefully dealt with, but also how this data is processed and how machines decide on you in your daily life, how that's being done. I think applying ethics to the ethical application of machine learning methods is, for me, a very, very important thing that needs to be taken care of.
The thing with GDPR is the intention is good.
the execution can be discussed, right?
But yeah, but it's being improved. Yeah. It's being worked on, so that's fine.
But you know what? I actually that is a really healthy, of course, point of view in terms of, let's say, realism, right? And it's an interesting concept. Like, what is like being realistic as well, right? And I think the deeper you are in the matter, the more you are scared of, let's say, this this hype, and the more you actually are also, you know, just like sick and tired of it, you know, because then because you see people that are, let's say, not as deep within the matter or not as knowledgeable, then promising or over-promising, mm-hmm. over-hyping things, mm-hmm. right? But I think...
I don't think there's a word like over-hyping, because hype is already hype. So if you over-hype, this is like a tautology.
That comes from a true scientist. No, yeah, true. You're 100% right on that. But I think... So I also think that that is the wrong approach you go about it, right? With this exactly, again, doomsday mentality and trying to scare people. I think that there's still this importance in the dialogue and the right communication of what change, let's say, this field brings, right? To all the different fields that we have. Mm-hmm. And also, let's say, to such a field of, you know, education and, let's say, the wider public, right? The greater public. Because... not everybody is like a scientist, you know, and not everybody is is this deep in the topics,
of course,
and knows what is going on in the world, you know. It's kind of like, because they're like, what I'm also always afraid of is that you will get to a point where you have this kind of digital elite, you know, where people know what is going on, mm-hmm. like with this, who are basically the perfect result of globalization, right? Mm-hmm. Just, you know, being able to be everywhere and speaking global languages and just knowing what's going on, and also having good education, higher education at top institutions and everything. And then, let's say, the wider masses, you know, just consuming products and services, you know,
yep.
and not really knowing that, you know, the average time of skill learned, you know, just decreases and decreases. And that speed is such an important, let's say, metric, ultimately, right? So I think the conversations are very critical there, you know.
Yeah, it is. But it starts in kindergarten, right?
Right.
And our society is certainly not anywhere there to look into that problem. I think the whole education with respect to this topic should begin at age 3, 4, 5 to have people, boys and girls, in the same time. That's another issue which is dramatically wrong in this country or in this continent. That boys are pushed into to technical people and girls are pushed in a more social direction from kindergarten age on. It's terrible. But I think from there on, I think we also need to make people aware of what these methodologies is, and it doesn't mean giving them a tablet in their hand or a smartphone in their hand and play with that. It goes much further than that. And I think we need to look into that issue of making us all citizens who are aware of possibilities, at the same time aware of threats, by just being informed.
Exactly. I think that is really, really, really good point to that. Being able to, exactly, just being informed. That is that is the critical one. Yeah, 100%. Well, that is such an interesting discussion, but we always try to kind of like be in this time frame of 60 minutes.
And let's do another one.
We're already, yes, of course. You know, the thing is, I'm actually planning to, let you know, within a time frame of X, you know, maybe a year or two. I mean, we will stay in touch, you know,
sure.
Do other things. But, you know, this, as you said, this field is moving so fast, you know, and there will be definitely things.
Not as fast as the public thinks it is.
But it's moving
fast. It is moving fast.
Well, the thing is, on how would you define fast and again, or speed in general. But yeah, so... actually, I want to come to the end right now with the last question. Is
yes.
also always the same. So the beginning is always the same, and the end is also always the same. We might change that up, but as of now, it has been working quite well. And so in the end, we always ask our, let's say, guest, and you probably will laugh a little bit about this question, to give a prediction from their point of view on an event or a matter that is, let's say, open to them. And within a time frame of X, also open up to you, you know? So something that you believe will happen in any field you would like to. But then don't make like an easy one, you know, like, yeah, you know, in like 2 months I will go on vacation or something like that. But like something that you, where you, what you have been thinking of, because we believe that the people that are kind of like, that we talk to are also like working and shaping the future. So you definitely have strong opinions on certain topics, events. So that is my last question for today.
This is a very, very difficult one. So let me give you two replies. I'm sometimes asked to predict what's going to happen in 5 years, and every time in this field, and every time I get asked that question, I have a standard answer for it, and I'm going to give that to you as the first one. And the standard answer is, as I told you, I've been at DLR for a long time, and I think the first year I came in, or maybe it was the second year I was there, I don't know. I heard this prediction of, in 5 years, everybody will have a robot at home. We're talking late 90s there. I've heard the same prediction at the same institute, maybe every other year again, right? And that's now almost 20 years ago. It didn't happen. So those people are the experts in robotics. Robotics research, certainly, that's different from the application, but those are the experts. And totally wrong, right? Because there is absolutely... So I would never like to predict what's going to happen in 5 years. That's number one. But that's not the answer you want to hear.
It's a good one as well. It's an opinion.
The second one is on transport. So I happen to be working in a company that is not an automobile company, but a mobility provider. And it takes a while to understand the difference between the two, even though it's more en vogue now than it was 3 years ago. But when services like Uber and Lyft came on the market, everybody was, oh, that's great, that's going to change mobility. And it did. What happened is they clogged the cities. And even in a city like Munich, you know, you can see the Uber drivers, because there is one person sitting in the back and one person sitting in the front, oh, that's an Uber driver. And they start clogging our streets. And in Asia, 10 times as bad as here, because they don't have any public transport infrastructure in many cities as we have here. So that's a negative part. So I'm pretty damn convinced that the mobility picture is going to change dramatically, and it's not going to be 5 years, it's going to be longer than that. But as a cyclist, when I go through Munich, and I also cycle through Berlin and through Amsterdam and through Tokyo and whatever, I kind of take a bike if possible, you see the advantages of cycling. Even though it's dangerous in some cities, like if you go to Copenhagen or Amsterdam, it's the cities are planned for that. But we need to have a much broader flexibility with respect to our transport pattern. And probably, and that will maybe go hand in hand with autonomous driving, the ownership of a car should be reduced to a decent level, so that we don't clog our streets with parked cars anymore. But how traffic is now in a city like Munich or most cities is a disaster. And I think that's society problem number one that needs to be solved. And everybody or anybody living not in a big city like we are, but outside in the countryside, will laugh about this because they have totally different view of that. And I understand that. But I feel
with you, and I very much agree with you.
So that's problem. I think for me, one of the biggest societal problems we have right now in the Western world, or in a large part of the world.
I think in general, because mobility / transport is, let's say, one of the key drivers of an economy.
Like exactly.
Without mobility, without transportation, without the without a proper infrastructure, economy cannot thrive.
You have no idea how much I hate a Skype teleconference because it doesn't work. It does not replace a real meeting.
All right, Patrick van der Smaak, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
That was a very, very interesting discussion.
I enjoyed it.